It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to WPR State Capitol reporter about today's unanimous vote to remove Representative Bill Cramer as Assembly Majority Leader.
First, our next guest is a veteran NPR journalist who got some alarming news of her own a few years ago. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. And while there was an overwhelming amount of information available about the disease, she felt like there was something missing, and she set out to fill in that gap.
Madalika Sika is with us now. She's executive editor for NPR News, and her new book is A Breast Cancer Alphabet. Madalika, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica, for inviting me.
Well, as you were waiting for the call from your doctor with a diagnosis back in 2010, you were at a big moment in your journalism career at the White House. What do you remember about that day?
It was mostly a blur. I was the executive producer of Morning Edition at the time, and Steve Inskeep was interviewing the president. I knew that we would... I would hear from the doctor at some point that afternoon. We finished the interview. We started looking at how we were going to edit it, and I saw there was a message from my doctor, and that's when I got the news. I called her. She didn't leave a voicemail. I did call her and had her paged, and she told me.
There's a lot of things going through your mind at that moment, all of the interview with the president going through your head along with words from your new vocabulary of breast cancer. And is that something that most women will remember their whole lives, that moment?
You know, I'm guessing that you probably will remember the diagnosis. That's something that even now, you know, more than 3 years later, I still remember quite vividly. But what I discovered that you probably might not remember much after that, and that's why I think it's really important to take notes. And that's not just because of my occupational hazard of being a journalist.
And there is a section for notes at the end of your book.
Yes. I think it's really important to have someone with you. My husband was my partner and stenographer, because you can be engaged in a conversation with your doctor, and then at some point it'll hit you, oh, she's talking about me. And you want someone to have been paying real close attention so you know what the doctor is saying to you. And if you have questions, you can go back. I think it's just really important to have. So we put blank pages at the back of the book so people can keep their own notes.
And that's one piece of advice, keeping notes. And your book is full of advice and also empathy. And you write that you found a lot of support from your science journalist friends, your family. You also found just an onslaught of information, but there were still gaps in the knowledge pool. What kinds of things were missing from the picture for you?
Well, I think the challenge in, you know, the information age is, the great thing is we live in the information age. The terrible thing is that we live in the information age. And it's really hard to sort it all out. And I think at particular stages as you're going through this, you know, at the beginning, I knew that if I had started, you know, penetrating the internet, I would have found all sorts of horrible and alarming things. So I very purposefully did not do that. There's a lot of great information out there in books, but most of it seemed very medical. I didn't find too much that was very focused on, well, what am I going through, me as a woman, me as a person, as opposed to the things that were happening to me medically.
And one of the things that you acknowledge is anxiety. It's the first letter in your book. It's probably not something you'd find on a healthcare website about breast cancer. But after your diagnosis, how big a part of your life was anxiety?
It's a big part. It actually starts even before the diagnosis, because in my case, you know, I had a mammogram and they call me back. And in that period where you're waiting to go back, you're anxious. And then you wait for the test and then you get the diagnosis. There's all sorts of anxiety. And it doesn't really go away. It just either recedes or comes to the forefront, depending on what stage in the treatment you're at.
It seems as though you enter a zone where things get very topsy-turvy very quickly. If you take, for instance, breast cancer, we're talking about your breasts, and this is something that has been private your whole life. And all of a sudden, everyone's talking about your breasts in a very clinical, public way. You say there are people taking pictures of your breasts. Well, how can women deal with that transition?
Well, you know, I have to say the photographs were quite a shock to me. But, you know, what your surgeons do is they want to know what they're dealing with, and what your plastic surgeon, if you have reconstruction, wants to know what he's going to do to try and make you whole. So it was shocking at first, because I was like, whoa, wait a minute, you're taking pictures and, you know, they're anonymous and he knows they're you, and it actually helps him do his work better. But it's really hard to deal with. It's really hard to deal with. So I thought that if it hadn't been a surprise to me, I might have, you know, dealt with it a little better at the beginning.
I noticed you said she when you were referring to the doctor and he when you were referring to your reconstructive surgeon. Do you think that's a norm for most women, that they're dealing with this very intimate part of their body, but it's a male surgeon?
I don't think so. It was just one of those quirks that I happened to have had a male plastic surgeon, but all my other doctors were female. I think it was a quirk. I must say I don't know enough to know whether most of the plastic mm-hmm. reconstruction surgeons are male or not, but it didn't strike me as something that was very deliberate.
Another letter in your alphabet, H, and you have hair as the topic of interest there. Now, in the face of a life or death illness, worrying about your hair seems like it might come in kind of low on the list, but you write to women that it's okay to freak out and to grieve over the loss of your hair. What advice do you have for women going through chemo-related hair loss?
It is tough, and I think it's okay to feel that way. What's interesting is, you know, I've had male friends who've gone through cancer and who've lost their hair, and it's really not such a deal. It just is for women. I think if we accept that, for most women, I should say, just accept that and, you know, live with it. I mean, what I chose to do was I actually had my hair shaved before it fell out. And that was as a result of talking to several people who had gone through treatment, and they felt that, you know, waking up with a clump of your hair on the pillow was sort of really difficult to deal with, and you don't have much control over many things, and I could control when I lost my hair by choosing when to do it. So for me, it worked. And I think that that is something I would encourage women to think about, what would work for them.
And when you shaved your head, you didn't do it in a solitary bathroom stall. It was with your friends and family, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there is a hairdresser here that was recommended to me by, you know, I'm sort of always amazed at how often I say recommended to me or something I learned from somebody else I knew, because so many women I know had gone through breast cancer. And he was terrific. He actually, you know, I got a wig through him. He styled the wig and he said, you know, we can shave your hair any way you like. If you want to bring your family, they do it in a private room. And so my daughters and my sister and some girlfriends and my husband were there, and we did it.
What was it like?
I had never thought of myself as bald, so it was tough, but you have to kind of roll with it. And I discovered that the shape of my head really wasn't that bad. but it is sort of, you take a breath when he brings the razor to your head and you start shaving, and it's like, there's no turning back now.
Was it helpful to have people there to cry with you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was. And I think, you know, it was, my girls were a little younger then. They were in, you know, lower school and middle school. And I think probably for me, I thought it was better for them to be there with me and see it happen as opposed to me come home one day bald. Hmm.
We're talking right now with Madalika Sikka. She's joining us to talk about her new book, A Breast Cancer Alphabet, sharing advice for women dealing with breast cancer.
You can join the conversation. Have you or someone close to you experienced breast cancer? What do you know now that you wished you knew then? What don't people understand about what it's like to have breast cancer? And do you have advice you'd like to share? We continue our conversation about breast cancer and living with breast cancer with Madalika Sikka. She's executive editor for NPR News. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010. Her new book is A Breast Cancer Alphabet.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have advice on dealing with the day-to-day reality of living with breast cancer? If you or someone close to you has dealt with the disease, what do you wish you'd known going in? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. And Madalika, I want to talk about the word journey, because this is something that kind of sticks in your craw. People seem to want to apply it to the process of being diagnosed with and treating breast cancer. What is it about the word journey that gets overused or used falsely here?
I think for me, journey is very much rooted in the sort of real here and now and going from place to place. And I've been fortunate enough to travel a lot, and I've taken some great journeys. And I think that when I hear people talk about your breast cancer journey, it sort of tries to impose something mystical about it, and it's not mystical. It's a disease. The treatment is terrible, and I don't think people don't talk about your heart disease journey or other. I don't know why it is so attached to cancer and breast cancer in particular, but having taken some great journeys, I'd like to just think about journeys in that way and not what I went through.
Did you ever voice that when people tried to use the J word with you?
Yeah, I think people know me well enough to know that they wouldn't have used it. Yes, I mean, what's been interesting is the kinds of things I've talked about with people. It's made them think about how they engage with people that they know who've gone through it. And it's been heartening to hear from people who have read the book, who have either gone through breast cancer and have, you know, said to me they wish they'd had this book then, or people who are going through it now who have really appreciated it as a companion.
Let's take a caller now. We have Alexis on the line from Monona. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Oh, I'm great. I am a 10-year survivor of breast cancer.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I was a young woman. I was barely 40 when I was diagnosed, and in the best shape of my life. And one thing that I kind of wish that people did for me, and granted it was with good intentions, was they gave me motivation material. Oh, this woman ran a marathon when she was going through chemo, and I was hurting, and I was sick from the chemo, and I had bone pain. And I just wanted to know that it was okay that I felt that way, that there were days I stayed in bed, and it was okay. And not to, I had to get up and go do something, even though I'm, very, very ill.
I think you are a woman after my own heart. I mean, I think that's something that I talk about in the book. The letter Q is for quitting. And precisely for those days where, I'm not getting out of bed. I feel terrible, and this is what I need to do for me right now. I think there's a bit of a pressure, the kind of breast cancer culture that has grown up, that you have to deal with it in a particular way. And what I want to do is let people know that, no, you can deal with it whichever way works for you.
And Alexis, did you have any more comments on that?
One more quick thing is that I kind of wish that I had not rushed into reconstruction. I barreled through this. I said, I know I want implants. I know I want this. And I to get my surgery, so I didn't have to have so many surgeries. I kind of bundled things together. I had my the implants start, the chest expanders put in when I had my mastectomy, and then I had my oophorectomy when I had my implants put in. And I didn't, I did the research, I did all the research I could about the cancer survival and the treatment, but not enough about what happens afterwards. And I encourage women to take their time and research that well, because they're pretty heavy decisions on how you're going to look when you're done.
I think that's really excellent advice.
All right, Alexis, thank you so much for calling in and sharing, and again, congratulations. And Menelik, let's talk about the word that Alexis just used, mastectomy. It's a word that enters the picture for a lot of women who have breast cancer. It's this tidy clinical package for something that's pretty drastic. What is your real-world view of what that word means?
Well, my real-world view is if we talked about it as an amputation, I think we would treat it differently. And it's funny how in sort of day-to-day parlance we use this medical term, a mastectomy, when in fact something quite brutal is happening to you. And for me, I sort of felt like I could handle it better in describing it as a amputation, because that's what it felt like and looked like to me. It's very painful. I think that when we use a clinical term, we don't think about the fact that it's a very drastic measure, and it hurts. And that's another thing nobody really knows before they go through it.
Right. And did you share that with the people around you, that this wasn't, just a medical procedure? This was a part of you.
Yeah, well, I was, yes. I mean, I think to the extent that I was comfortable talking about it, certainly with my my sisters and my, girlfriends, and actually my husband as well. Yeah, there's pain attached with it. I wasn't, bouncing out of bed 2 days after I'd had the surgery. It's major surgery.
I want to talk about one other point Alexis made. And by the way, we'd like to invite you to call in on this. We're talking with Madalika Sicca, executive editor for NPR News, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010. Her new book is called A Breast Cancer Alphabet. And our caller Alexis talked about, you know, women who ran marathons when they were going through chemotherapy or through the breast cancer treatment. And that brings me to the warrior aspect, which you write about in your book, about there sometimes seems to be this challenge, this idea of beating and fighting cancer. Why didn't the idea of being a warrior fit your experience?
It didn't fit my experience because I struggled with the treatment. It also didn't work for me. And I think one of the sort of downsides of this attitude, if you have to have this attitude of you've got to kick it and you've got to be very martial and about it all and have that kind of attitude, it implies that if you don't, then you don't deserve to get better, or that, like, you know, I like to say a bad attitude didn't give me cancer and a good attitude won't get rid of it. And, you know, I know too many people whose cancer has come back. Metastatic cancer is a real issue for women, metastatic breast cancer. And so the implication is that if you didn't, if somehow you, you know, 40,000 women a year die of it, did they not fight? Did they not want to live? Were they not, you know, fighting all the way through? There's an implication there that just doesn't sit well with me.
It's sort of one of the bigger picture things. What you're saying here is whatever your experience is going through this, it's valid and it's okay. You don't have to try to embody a warrior. You don't have to go on a mystical journey. Whatever happens to you is okay.
Yeah, whatever works for you. And I think, you know, the writer Peggy Orenstein wrote a great piece in the New York Times Magazine called Our Feel-Good War on Breast Cancer. And I think we sort of tip the balance. It has become a feel-good war, you know, something. The breast cancer awareness movement is an extraordinarily important episode in women's health and vital to women's health. And we're aware, and now we have to help people get through it. And I think that you've got to get through it in a way that works for you.
Do you think there's something about it being a woman's disease that invites the warm fuzzies?
Probably. You know, probably. That's a rash generalization. I know people may criticize me for that. But yeah, you know, and I think that the tough thing about when you are going through it, when you see all these campaigns and these, you know, pink teddy bears and the NFL clad in pink, and it's hard to find a direct line from the NFL being clad in pink to what I went through. And so I think awareness is really important. And I would venture to say that what I'm trying to do is, in this book, is to make people aware of the things they might not have been aware of in these campaigns.
In terms of the support people that surround a woman with breast cancer, do you have advice for them about how to be supportive and do the right things and not annoy and all of that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, talking to the loved one in your life and for the patient, you know, being very clear about what you need and what you don't need. People really want to help you and they want to do something useful. So, you know, I talk about this in the book, and K is for kindness. People will ask you what they can help you with, and you have to think about it not too long and not too hard, and then you have to tell them what you need. And it may be, you know, dropping your kid off somewhere or driving you to the hospital, or it may be feeding your family, which, you know, all my friends got together and had a rather elaborate, amazing calendar online where we were fed for 5 months. And, you know, that is huge. And I don't want anything. You know, that was exactly what we needed. So I think a little bit of honesty and really mean it. If you want to ask someone, what can I do to help, really mean that you want to help.
And once a woman is through her diagnosis, the surgery, the treatment, you know, there'll always be drugs to take and check-ins down the road. But you write that the memories never really go away. So what kind of comfort can you leave women with for life after cancer?
I think that, you know, managing your anxiety and knowing that that's what you're living with and calibrating it within the rest of your life. You know, I would never say to anyone that, well, you should just forget about it. It's done, because I don't feel that way. It's not done. And as I say, metastatic breast cancer is a really important issue. And many other cancers come back. You know, there is no cure. What they're doing is reducing the odds of it coming back. But who knows if there's some errant cell running around. It's not at the forefront of my head, but It's there somewhere in the background.
And you're back to life, though. It's the things, the day-to-day life that you want back, that I guess that part can come back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You find that, you know, your life wasn't really that bad before. So getting back to it is a good thing.
Madalika, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been speaking with Madalika Sicca, executive editor of NPR News and author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at the science behind Harry Potter-style magic and science fiction-style technology.
First, we're talking about today's vote to remove Bill Cramer from his position as Wisconsin's Assembly Majority Leader. Two women have accused the Waukesha politician of sexual harassment and verbal abuse while he was in Washington, D.C. last week for a GOP fundraiser.
Yesterday, a third allegation emerged involving a Wisconsin congressional staffer. It's not connected to his time in D.C. last week, though. It apparently happened in the recent past. One of Cramer's aides says he has checked himself into a rehab facility and is not making contact with the outside world.
Today, Assembly Republicans unanimously voted to remove Cramer from his leadership position. Sean Johnson was at the public vote, and he's here to fill us in on what happened. He's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Assembly Republicans unanimously voted to remove Bill Cramer from his position as majority leader today. What was the process and the tone like?
Well, this is a caucus meeting. This is just Assembly Republicans meeting amongst themselves. Often these meetings are closed. In fact, they closed today's meeting for quite a while to talk about what they were going to do. But then they opened it up and, you know, usually in a leadership contest or when you're going to take a step that involves leadership, you have members give speeches for and against people that are running. In this instance, you didn't have anyone stand up and speak on behalf of Bill Cramer, who was not there. He's checked into a treatment facility. You had two representatives stand up and say, we can't have this, we have to get rid of him. And then there was a quick vote, and Assembly Republicans said it was unanimous to get rid of Bill Cramer as majority leader.
Now, you said a couple of people spoke. What did they say?
Basically that we can't tolerate this, that they were disappointed, and that we have to send a message that this is not okay. And then you had not coincidentally, you had two women run for the position to replace Bill Cramer, Representative Mary Williams, Representative Pat Strakota. Both of them are leaving after this legislative session. So, they're only going to, they were only going to hold the job temporarily. They both spoke on behalf of each other. Pat Strakota won that election. And so she now becomes the first woman ever to hold the majority leader position in the Wisconsin State Assembly.
Now, as you said, she's going to be leaving in fairly short order. Why was she chosen with such an early exit date ahead of her?
I think that's probably one of the factors. I mean, they wanted to put this Bill Cramer story behind them as quickly as they could. And if you open this majority leader job up to somebody who might want to hold it for a few years, I mean, it's the number two position in the assembly. And, The action that they're taking to sort of oust Bill Cramer might be overshadowed by the campaign to replace them, So they wanted to move quickly. They wanted to get this over with. And this will give them, whoever wants to be majority leader for the long term, a chance to kind of, prove their worth through campaigning this November. And so we really don't know who those candidates are going to be. But essentially the campaign for that job begins now.
Well, Governor Scott Walker came out earlier in support of removing Cramer for his position as majority leader if the allegations proved credible. How important were the governor's comments in the situation and what happened today?
I think by the time the governor made his comments, they had already pretty much made up their mind. I mean, it's pretty stunning how quickly they acted here. These allegations against Representative Cramer were something that first surfaced in a news report last Friday night. By Saturday, he was supposed to meet with Speaker Voss to discuss what to do going forward, but his office put out a statement, Representative Cramer's office put out a statement saying that he had checked into a treatment center. We don't know much more beyond that. And by that afternoon, Representative Voss's office put out a statement saying, he's lost our trust, and we're going to meet Tuesday to replace him. And there were really no hiccups along the way, you know, so it wasn't as if Scott Walker was going out on a limb there, mm-hmm. making the statements that he did. You know, Kramer was pretty firmly out of the circle of trust by that point.
So it sounds like things were fast-tracked. Were there hints in Bill Kramer's behavior previously that someday there might be an event like this so that maybe people were prepared?
Well, there was a pretty personal hint dropped, actually, when Bill Kramer was elected majority leader, and this was just back in September. You know, as I mentioned, normally when you have elections like this, you have people get up and give speeches on behalf of or against the people running. And in Representative Kramer's case, you had Representative Chris Kapinga, a fellow Waukesha County Republican, get up and say, you know, I've observed Bill Kramer at several events, and there is a pattern of behavior, and he called it habitual. He didn't get into too many details there as to what that behavior was, but then he went on to say, we can't have sexual innuendos and bad language in the public. He said that, you know, he had just observed him at a recent conference. It was American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, conference. He said that Kramer did not represent well and said that can never happen. So, you know, it was a pretty big hint there, and happened very recently. And so, you know, Speaker Robin Voss was actually asked about that today, said, should people have listened to Chris Kapinga? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Voss said, you know, nobody had observed the type of behavior that Representative Kramer faces in these allegations now.
So at the time, he had the confidence of his colleagues, despite some hints that maybe things were not going to go well in the future.
Right. And, you know, it's just a sign today of how quickly things can change in the assembly. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, just a week ago, Bill Kramer was the majority leader, and, you know, no signs that that was going to change anytime soon. You know, he went to Washington, D.C. to represent his caucus at, you know, a pretty big fundraiser. And, you know, now today he had not a single person stand up and speak on his behalf.
What details do we know about the rehab facility that Kramer has reportedly checked himself into?
If the details are out there, I don't know any of them. And nobody's really gotten into what type of treatment center it is. We do know Speaker Voss said that in one of the alleged incidents, that Representative Kramer was impaired, that he'd been drinking. Other times he was not. And so, you know, you could make a guess that the treatment involves alcohol, but we don't know that. I mean, we just haven't seen information put out about that. And, you know, because of the nature of these treatment centers, it may be that Representative Kramer is actually basically, you know, closed off from the outside world now. And so we haven't heard from him about what's going on, and we're unlikely to for a while.
Is there expected to be a political price tag, maybe among Assembly Republicans, for Bill Kramer's his actions? Or is the fact that he was quickly removed and replaced with a woman, will that kind of take care of it and call it done?
Well, I mean, there is a recent history, actually, in the state assembly of the assembly censuring another state representative for behavior that they didn't think was appropriate. And that was Jeff Woods, a Republican lawmaker turned independent who had repeat drunk driving incidents on his record. Republicans sought to censure him, and that was after Woods started voting with Democrats. So, you know, we have a pretty recent incident where the assembly did stand up and make a public showing that, hey, we don't support that. Speaker Voss says they have no plans of doing that in the remaining two floor session days that are scheduled for this legislative session. And he says that he just hopes that Representative Kramer does not seek re-election. If he does come back to the legislature, Voss says that they'll have to put some type of safety measures in place for people that still work in the assembly who have concerns with Kramer.
Now, you mentioned Representative Pat Strakota, the new majority leader in the assembly. Will there be pressure after she leaves to leave that leadership role in the hands of a woman?
I think that's possible, yeah. I mean, Republicans know that Democrats, one of their attacks against the Republican Party has been that Republicans are engaging in this war on women. And so when you have incidents like the Kramer incident pop up, you know, it bolsters Democrats' case. And so, you know, they elected a woman today, and looking ahead, it could be that they want to do that in the future. Although I imagine that you're going to have some competition for that majority leader job, given, you know, how high ranking it is.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, and he was with us to talk about the vote to remove Assembly Majority Leader Bill Kramer on grounds of recent sexual harassment allegations.
A lot of us here at Central Time enjoy a good work of science fiction or fantasy every now and then, and sometimes you wonder whether or not the stuff in these books and movies could actually happen in real life.
Well, our next guest decided to take it one step further. In a new book, he looks at popular works of science fiction and fantasy through the lens of physics and math. And by applying real-life formulas to some of the scientific questions that these works pose, he tries to figure out what could be reality and what's just out of this world.
Charles Adler joins us now. He's a professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland and the author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships, Physics and Math in Fantasy and Science Fiction. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, you're a physicist and you grew up as a fan of science fiction. What made you want to put those two together and apply the scientific lessons you knew to the fiction you were reading?
Well, I actually started as a scientist because I read science fiction. I started reading the science fiction first and got interested in science because of all these, you know, strange and neat ideas like space travel or, you know, artificial intelligence, things like that, in meeting aliens in the science fiction books that I was reading, and it led me into science. But as I started learning more and more science, I started to realize that a lot of the science portrayed in science fiction stories wasn't all that accurate. And so I started thinking about what was more realistic and what wasn't realistic. And so I kind of brought it all together again when I started looking at this book. It's a book I've been thinking about quite literally since I was about 15 years old.
As someone who's a fan of science fiction and fantasy, and also, you know, the math and you know the physics, do you get more out of these works of sci-fi and fantasy by knowing the math and the underpinnings beneath them?
Sure. I think knowing more helps you enjoy them more. I mean, my daughters will sometimes look at me and say, well, why are you spoiling the story for us, Dad? But I actually do think that thinking about it more helps you enjoy it more. You know, I won't say that I will expect every piece of science fiction to be completely accurate, and that I won't enjoy it unless it is. But I think it does add something to the story to see where it is accurate and to actually enjoy a story that's, you know, well-crafted and where people have actually been thinking about the science in it.
Well, what surprised me was you don't start off with science fiction. You start off with Harry Potter, a fantasy thing. And usually with fantasy, you think, oh, that doesn't make sense. Oh, well, it's magic. But you are looking at least for some sort of internal consistency and some obedience to scientific principles, even with the magic. Why?
Well, because if you look at it, there are actually a large number of fantasy writers who do pay attention to that sort of thing. Poole Anderson, for example, who was better known as a science fiction writer, did write several fantasy novels in which he actually did pay attention to some, not all of the laws of science, but some of the laws of science, like, for example, the law of conservation of mass. You know, he paid attention to these, and I think it kind of enriched the stories because it kind of put boundaries on what the people in the stories could do and couldn't do. I love the Harry Potter stories, but you do sometimes get a sense that J.K. Rowling was sort of making up the rules as she went along. You know, there are a number of things in the stories which you look at and you start thinking, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. You know, for example, I mean, in the third book, they give, you know, a time machine, you know, for crying out loud, to the equivalent of a high school student in order for her to take more class.
Right, in the form of what? It's a watch, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a watch. It could get easily lost. Someone could pick it up and start using it for their own purposes. Even if not, the potential is that, you know, she could do a whole lot of damage just by using a time machine there. And so, you know, it's there to provide a story, provide a plot point for the story, but it doesn't make a lot of sense when you view it, you know, kind of in a larger context.
Well, let's dig into some of the other science that you just mentioned in passing there, mass conservation. Now, this is something that involves a plot line where Draco Malfoy gets turned into a ferret.
Always with the ferrets on the show.
Yeah.
So tell me, how does that go over scientifically?
Not that well, because there's this law we call the conservation of mass energy. It's the most famous formula in physics, E equals MC squared. You can't get rid of mass. You can convert it into energy, or a better way of saying it might be that mass is a form of energy in some sense, but it can be converted at a very, very high price. 90,000 trillion joules for every kilogram of matter, about 2 pounds or so of matter, that you turn into energy. Put that in context, that's enough for every kilogram that you do. That's enough energy to power the United States, all of its energy needs, for about 8 hours. So if you think about turning Draco into a ferret, if all that excess mass gets released as energy, that's something like the equivalent of 10 hydrogen bombs going off all at once. So you start thinking about these things, you think, well, every time that something gets turned into something else, Hogwarts ought to be flattened by an atomic bomb, the equivalent of an atomic bomb explosion.
That may have been a tough plot point to work around there.
Right. You can think of lots of fun things like this. You start thinking, E equals MC squared can actually get you very, very far with a lot of these things. If you remember the Enterprise, for example, in Star Trek, going to a science fiction example, the Enterprise is powered by, matter, antimatter reactions.
Sounds like Scotty.
Yeah. The idea is very simple. You take matter and you take antimatter in equal quantities and you toss them together and they convert themselves, you annihilate the matter and antimatter into pure energy, essentially light in the form of very, very, very high energy X-rays, gamma rays, we typically call them. And you can actually use that to move a starship forward. It's a very, very effective way of doing it. There were actually serious proposals back in the 1980s by a scientist, not coincidentally also a science fiction writer, named Robert Forward, to actually create matter and antimatter to use as fuel for starships, for spaceships. The problem is that antimatter doesn't really exist in the real universe in any large quantities. We produce tiny, tiny, tiny bits of it in particle accelerators all over the world, but at the equivalent cost of something like trillions of dollars per pound at today's energy prices. And when you're talking about something like the USS Enterprise, you're talking about, many millions of pounds of starship fuel that you'd need to power the spaceship. So you're looking at costs in fueling this thing of like trillions upon trillions of dollars, simply because of this idea of the conservation of mass and energy. You have to be able to, if you want to create antimatter out of nothing, you have to spend an enormous amount of energy to do it.
Well, on a little closer to Earth, where are those flying cars that the science fiction authors were promising us? Why aren't those more plausible?
For a couple of reasons. Number one, I think that one of the problems involved with that is that the fuel costs get very high. If you start looking at the fuel costs for, say, putting a regular Toyota Corolla, something equivalent to that, in the air, you start talking about much, much, much larger engines. Flight is actually pretty energy expensive. If you start talking about, driving a car down and having it pull out wings like in James Bond stories and having it take off into flight, it turns out that it actually, in order to overcome the drag forces on the car, it actually and keep it up in the air, it needs to exert a lot of energy. And as you make the car bigger, the energy costs actually scale disproportionately with the weight. It does turn out to be not very fuel economical in terms of fuel to actually get a car to fly. You also have the problem, of course, that if you run out of fuel in a car, for example, you can pull off to the side of the road. But doing the same thing in a flying car is not so much fun.
Well, then there's the question of the other drivers. I mean, it's bad enough working in two dimensions sometimes.
True. Right, exactly. And training them and all, I think driver's ed becomes a lot more difficult at that point as well, if you want to get people in. I think there have been some serious proposals that I've read about recently actually using computers to control the flight in the cars. You wouldn't have these, you know, issues with the drivers. But I think the fuel costs are still going to do it in the end.
And Charles, just real quick, in our last moment of time here, what is the coolest thing that you found that actually is plausible in science fiction?
The coolest thing I found that's actually plausible in science fiction, I will say it's kind of on the border of plausibility. I'm a little dismissive of it in the book because I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but I love the idea of the space elevator, the idea of, you know, a transport system to space, which would actually involve taking a satellite and stretching it out, you know, so the one end goes up into space, the other end goes toward the ground, keeping the center of gravity in an orbit that stays at one point above the Earth's, or above the Earth's surface at all times, and stretching it to the point where it'll actually, one end will touch the ground and the other end will go out to space. You can actually literally ride an elevator out into space. And it seems to be just barely, what I love about the idea is that based on kind of materials issues, it seems to be just barely plausible.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Charles Adler, professor of physics at St. Mary's College of Maryland, author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships.